This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zacharin, the assistant editor of the New Books Network, and you're listening to New Books in Politics. Today, I'm speaking with Andrew Bacevich about his new book, co-edited with Daniel A. Scherson, Paths of Dissent, Soldiers Speak Out Against America's Misguided Wars, which was published by Metropolitan Books and features essays from veterans of America's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. In the essays, veterans define what it means to dissent from America's forever wars and the toll inflicted on people abroad and in our military. Andrew Bacevich is himself a military veteran, having served in the U.S. Army for 23 years. He is Professor Emeritus of History and International Relations at Boston University, in addition to serving as the President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Andrew, thank you for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Oh, thank you so much for doing this. Appreciate it.
Of course. This was a really fantastic book. I enjoyed reading it, and I think, you know, people should really check out these essays because they're very eye-opening. And before getting into the book, the first thing I'd like to ask you is if you could just tell us a little bit about your background and how it is that you came to put this book together.
As you mentioned, I'm a veteran. More specifically, I graduated from West Point long ago, back in 1969, served in Vietnam, stayed in the Army for 20 years, and then became an academic. So I taught at Boston University for quite a while and began to write books. It was during really that period of time that I began to think critically about America's chosen role in the world and about what I consider to be our radical misuse of military power. And that became the focus of my own writing. A couple of years ago, Danny Scherson and I, Danny is much younger than I am. He is a veteran of Iraq and of Afghanistan and a published author. I think we met over a beer one night at some bar and hatched this notion of putting together an anthology in which we would invite of a wide variety of veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan to reflect on what their military service meant to them. And the book that we're talking about is the result of that initial agreement between the two of us.
Is this book, you know, in any way for you reflective of the work that you do with Quincy? How does this book and the contents in it relate to the more activist-oriented work that you do today?
So the Quincy Institute is a small and quite new, recently founded think tank in Washington. And our purpose is specifically to try to promote the principle of restraint as a foundation for U.S. policy. And we believe that the United States has misused military power, particularly since 9/11, particularly since the wars that the contributors to this book participated in. So there's certainly an overlap between the role I play in Quincy and the contents of this volume. But I think what's different is that the purpose of the book is really to provide these veterans with an opportunity to reflect on what their military service and their participation in war has meant to them. You know, none of them are generals. None of them are admirals. They are younger people. And therefore, their encounter with war has been immediate. And we wanted the book to give them a chance to reflect on what that all meant to them.
So the book is titled Paths of Dissent. And I wanted to ask you, you know, for you personally, what does dissent mean? And based on, you know, the essays in the book from the other veterans, if there's a sort of coherent idea of dissent that you all share, or if there's different notions, different understandings of dissent that the different contributors brought to the book?
I think that's a good question, but I think the simple answer is no. There's no doubt that Danny and I wanted to recruit contributors who had something critical to say about war. We're not necessarily as that they had become pacifists, certainly not that they had become anti-American as a result of their war, but that they had come away from their military experience with critical things to say. There's a lot of cheerleading when it comes to war. Certainly there was a lot of cheerleading in the wake of 9/11. None of the contributors to this book are cheerleaders when it comes to war. That said, we did not intend, nor did we end up with a single theme. I think we've got 15 essays in the book. There's 15 different voices from people who had 15 different experiences. And it's true, I think, that some of the contributors came away from their own personal experiences having become anti-war, period. Others came away critical of very specific wars. You know, this one, but not that one. And I think from my own point of view as a co-editor, I think one of the virtues of the collection is that we're not all singing one song here, that there are a variety of views about what it means to serve in war, and that taken collectively, those views are really worth thinking about. I mean, worth having our fellow citizens think about. Most of us don't serve. Most of us don't go to war. But these young Americans did. And I think our conviction, that is to say Danny's conviction, my conviction, is that they've got something to say and they ought to be heard.
The book is dedicated to the memory of Major Ian Fishback, and in your introductory essay, you discuss this man, and I was wondering if you could just tell the audience a little bit about him and why you chose to dedicate the book to him.
So I never met Ian Fishback, who is deceased, recently deceased. And he created a stir early on in the global war on terrors as an active duty officer by informing his members of his chain of command of abuses that were being done by American soldiers. And the chain of command blew him off. And Ian, who clearly, again, I never met him, but who clearly was a highly principled individual, refused to be blown off. He took his concern to the media. He took his concern to politicians, to include John McCain, Senator of Arizona. And when he went public, of course, his charges gained a lot of publicity. Briefly, Ian became a famous guy. That said, whether or not it was due to his own participation in war or whether he was haunted by other things, he ended up having a very, very difficult life. I had asked him to contribute an essay. He wrote something. For reasons that I discussed briefly in the book, don't need to go in here today, it was not publishable. And I told him that in an email. I never heard back. And then subsequently he died. And I know when, you know, he had been undergoing psychiatric treatment. He had significant troubles, I suppose we would say. It was PTSD, but I'm not a doctor, so how do I know? Clearly, he was a man of great integrity, who spoke up when speaking up was much in need, and who suffered severe consequences as a result of that. So Danny and I thought that, you know, this is an exemplary American soldier. And it was for that reason that, even though he was not able to contribute to the book, we thought it was appropriate for us to dedicate the book in his memory.
So there's somewhere between, I don't know the exact number, 10 to 15 essays in this book. I was curious how you came into contact with some of these veterans and how you asked them to contribute, or how some of the particular essays came about, the maybe individual stories of them.
So I had made contact. I had come to know some of these people. Danny had come to know some of these people. There were others that we didn't know, but, you know, kind of casting out lines, telling people, well, this is what our plan is. We're trying to put a book together. Do you have any thoughts on who might be a good contributor? That ended up giving us a pool of contributors. Now, to tell you the truth, and I think this is probably the way it is with all projects like this one, you know, if you've recruited 20 people to write essays, guess what? All 20 don't come through. You know, some do, some don't. Some of the ones that do, you know, take some effort, some editorial effort. That's what editors are supposed to do. Danny and I are the co-editors. So it was a bit of a struggle, I guess, to put the book together. I'm obviously biased here, but I think the essays that we ended up with are first rate. And to go back to a point we've already made, I'm especially proud of the fact that they don't all say the same thing. That there's a variety of perspective here, and it's that variety of perspective, I think, that makes this a book that you can learn from. That's what Danny and I hope, anyway.
Were there any essays that when you received them, you know, they had either maybe a poetic way of saying something that you felt expressed a feeling that you had had before, or maybe said something that sort of shocked you or stopped you in your tracks?
Well, I don't know. There are some personal testimonials in the book of suffering, physical, psychological, of anguish. And they make painful reading. I don't think when Danny and I went into this, we expected to have that be a result, but it ended up being a result. None of these people are unscathed by their experiences. Some of them, I think, are pretty badly damaged. And that's something that we all of us need to confront, because damaged human beings is really one of the consequences of war. Set aside death, set aside physical wounds, that there are psychological damage that comes from involvement in combat. I don't pretend to be an expert in that, but it seems to me manifestly true. And just because we live in an era of high-tech war doesn't diminish that reality. And I think that one of the themes that comes out of the book is that, and that there are aspects of the experience of combat that are basically unchanged from what they were 100 years ago. Despite all the high-tech weaponry that is on the battlefield now.
You mentioned at the beginning of the interview that, you know, American military policy or American wars have gotten especially, you know, brutal or wrongheaded since 9/11. What do you see as some of the principal causes or factors leading to a shift or just leading to, you know, these wars that we're seemingly can never get out of or just are stuck in?
Oh, I think hubris. I think that's a quality that the architects of the Afghanistan and Iraq wars certainly shared. The architects themselves had virtually no firsthand experience in war, but they thought they had war figured out. They thought that the United States, that the armed forces of the United States had mastered war. They reached that conclusion, for example, based on the outcome of the Persian Gulf War of 1991 and some smaller skirmishes in the Balkans and elsewhere. So they entered into the so-called global war on terrorism with expectations that, as one observer put it, this was going to be a cakewalk, that we were going to win. We were going to win easily and decisively, and we were going to pay a minimal cost. And that just turned out to be a massive error of judgment that, of course, the architects of the wars basically did not pay for. Rather, it was the young people that we sent to Iraq and Afghanistan who ended up paying the price.
This is a, you know, sort of a two-part question, but one is, you know, for those people like myself who have not participated in the military in any way, you know, what do you want people like me to take away from this book? And then also, you know, do you have hopes for veterans or for currently enlisted soldiers that they might find the courage to dissent, or that they might, you know, feel like they aren't alone if they are having questions about what they might be doing or engaged in?
Well, you know, I don't think Danny and I were trying to subvert good order and discipline in the armed forces. We're not trying to get everybody in uniform to stand up and say, hell no, I won't go. I, as an American citizen of a democracy, I do believe that those who serve should be well informed. Becoming a soldier doesn't mean that you forfeit your rights. We want our soldiers to be well informed just as much as we want you to be well informed. You know, what should a young person such as yourself take away from all this? Yeah, you know, I guess I hope that the non-participants come to appreciate how irresponsible it is to take the country to war for any reason that is less than absolutely essential to our own well-being. Now, supporters of the Iraq, for example, the invasion of Iraq in 2003, they were making a case that we had to invade Iraq because supposedly Saddam Hussein was developing weapons of mass destruction. It would be a horrible thing if he did. Of course, that was not true. And indeed, at the time, there were many observers, informed observers, who said it was not true that Saddam Hussein was developing weapons of mass destruction. The George W. Bush administration decided to invade anyway. It's my conviction that the motivation for their invasion was not had nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction. It had to do with a grandiose vision of how to remake the entire greater Middle East, to, you know, get rid of dictatorships, spread democracy, peace and harmony. And again, they thought that that grand ambition was feasible because they believed we had mastered the art of war. So I guess I would want younger people, older people, all Americans to reflect on how wrong that expectation was, how reckless. And by reading books like this one, and there are others, to come to an appreciation of the awful consequences suffered by those who we send to serve, to participate in these wars. I think if we could get readers to do that, we would have accomplished a lot.
You know, I think that something, you know, that really stuck out from these essays, you know, just there is one essay in particular titled "As American as It Gets" by Eric Edstrom, or just some of the descriptions of his experiences on the battlefield are just absolutely shocking and, you know, frightening to read. And, you know, the way that he just describes his experience, I think that, like, you know, it's there's a difficulty sometimes where, you know, because, you know, percentage wise, so few people really in America really end up seeing battlefield. There isn't this real knowledge of like what the experience is like, and the experience that people get, or that a lot of people learn about war, is either through, you know, secondhand sort of stories that, you know, who knows, or from the media. And, you know, to what extent do you think that, you know, the media and maybe video games or other things contribute to, you know, maybe the glorification of war, or the fact that we forget that there are real people involved in fighting?
Well, you just said a lot there. You know, I don't do video games. I don't go to all the movies that kind of spin off of that world, you know, the world of comics and so on. I see the coming attractions. And I have to think that they're basically made for what? Males ages 14 to 26. I think that's the demographic somewhere in there.
Right, definitely.
And I have to think that probably they're very effective. That is to say, very effective in selling movie tickets, but very effective in conveying a particular sense of what war is. And that it's somehow it's glamorous, it's quick, and that's a huge misunderstanding. I don't know that any one book is going to change that. There are many books, wonderful books, that go back as far as, decades, that offer a realistic understanding of what war really means. We're adding our own voices to that honorable project. But I would say, even if we're not going to make a decisive difference, that nonetheless, it is an honorable project. And you know, I'm frankly proud that I was able to participate in it.
You know, in your years of being a dissenting voice, how do you experience the present moment and the current state of dissent? What is, you know, people are allowed to talk about, or skepticism that people might have? How does it compare to, you know, the past couple decades, or even longer, you know, going back to the Vietnam War?
Well, the Vietnam War is the interesting case to compare with, I think, because of the level of dissent in the country at large and the level of dissent within the military. Both the military that was in Vietnam and the military that was serving during Vietnam, but was, for example, in Germany or in Korea or back here in the United States. I think we've seen nothing that would compare to that in an intensity. And maybe that's appropriate. You know, the scale of the Vietnam War, the level of violence was much greater than Iraq and Afghanistan. Iraq and Afghanistan were very long wars, but I think, you know, they were not big wars. If the big wars were, especially the two world wars, and then, you know, a step below, you get to Vietnam and Korea. Iraq and Afghanistan are actually sort of modest in terms of their size, in terms of the casualties, numbers of Americans dead, numbers of Americans wounded. I'm not trying to suggest they were trivial, but they were on a lesser scale. On the other hand, I think as important chapters in our national history, they probably were just as important as Vietnam, and quite frankly, perhaps even the world wars. I fear that they're going to be categorized as something lesser. You know, you and I are speaking in the midst of the Ukraine war. And I think one of the unfortunate effects of the Ukraine war is that it leads Americans to forget about Iraq and Afghanistan. And the country, sadly, has already moved on. There ought to be intense reflection on those two wars, our wars, what they cost, why they failed, the implications of their failure, what that should mean, for example, with regard to a military system that relies on volunteers to fight for what purports to be a democracy. But I don't see any of that kind of reflection going on. That's unfortunate. And I think, again, in a very small way, I wouldn't want to overstate it, I think in a very small way, our book is trying to push back against that inclination to forget.
You know, to sort of to summarize, you know, two questions I wanted to ask you are, one, if there are any other books that you're working on, anything else, that any other projects, and also, you know, just generally, you know, about your work with Quincy and what Quincy's goals are, or if there's anything in particular, even in this present moment, that you want to direct people's attention towards.
Well, this is a challenging moment for Quincy. So we stand for restraint. And I would emphasize, we're not pacifists. You know, we're not anti-war. We're certainly not anti-American. We think that it is in the interest of the American people for us to have a different approach to policy, particularly when it comes to the use of military power. And the Ukraine war, and let me emphasize, an awful episode attributed to criminal activity by Vladimir Putin, is kind of hijacking any debate. Ukraine has become the most important factor in U.S. foreign policy. It, for example, a big thing for us at Quincy is the climate crisis. And I think there's no question that the Ukraine war has caused, has distracted attention from the climate crisis. And we're going to pay for that in the long run, or even in the not so long run. So it's a difficult time for us to make an argument that says, no, restraint ought to be a core principle that guides American diplomacy. On the other hand, you know, I'm very proud to be part of an undertaking that is making that argument. And we're going to stick to our principles. I almost said stick to our guns, but that's not what I mean. And we're going to stick to our principles and make our argument. And I think that that time will vindicate restraint as a core principle that we ought to follow.
And are there any other book projects that you're working on?
Well, I hesitate to tell you. I've begun work on a novel.
Oh, okay, great.
I've never written fiction, and I've persuaded myself at my advanced age that I should take a crack at writing a novel. So I've just begun work on a novel that is, it's a military novel. It's about military people, and it is post-Vietnam in what was then called West Germany. And I won't bore you with the plot, but it's proving to be a great challenge for me at my advanced age of 75. We'll see if I actually follow through and get it done. I hope I can.
Or, you know, maybe you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but do you have any favorite military novels yourself that you would recommend?
Oh, absolutely. James Salter, The Hunters, very short novel about fighter pilots in Korea. Salter himself, who, by the way, was a West Pointer, served in the Air Force and flew fighter jets in Korea. It is a brilliant piece of work. There's a forgotten novel by James Gould Cozzens, Cozzens, called Guard of Honor, situated in wartime Florida, World War II, but it's stateside. And it's a brilliant sort of reflection on what military life is all about by those who experience it. Not the officers, enlisted, spouses, the people who live downtown. It's got a racial theme that is very interesting. And I think we shouldn't forget From Here to Eternity, James Jones, his great novel about the Army at the outset of World War II, situated in Hawaii. And of course, made into a fabulous film not long after it was published.
Well, I'll have to check those out.
Have you not read any of them?
I've not read any of them. I think I've read All Quiet on the Western Front.
Well, I should have mentioned that. That is a stunningly brilliant piece of work. What I would say is start with James Salter and The Hunters. It's only like 180 pages long, but it is a masterful piece of work.
Well, when you add your name to the pantheon of fiction writers, we hope to have you on someday. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for being a guest of the New Books Network. It was great talking to you. The book is Paths of Dissent. I highly recommend people check it out, even just to read an essay or two. It's really a fascinating read.
Thank you.